Okay. We were supposed to have the Da Vinci Code for music, but that's okay. We had the Cal fight song. The lecture today is Breaking the Code. It's on the periodic table, and hopefully it will start to pull some things together about the properties of the atom. Last time we ended by realizing that you could use photoelectron spectroscopy in order to actually figure out the energies of the different electrons in an atom. And that also lets you identify what atoms you have, and you can calibrate and figure out how many atoms you have. So this whole idea of light interacting with matter is incredibly important. It's going on in many labs around the world as we speak. It is the primary way of figuring out what you have, how much, what the composition is. It's going on in medical labs and in lots of different places. Okay, so today we want to look at how the periodic properties of atoms can be understood in terms of the location of the electron. So we want to go back to the periodic table. This was on the pre-class assignment, and what this does for you is overlays the subshell model on the periodic table. So earlier in the year, we had simply said there is a shell, a first shell, a second shell, a third shell, a fourth shell. We'd actually even wondered what was going on right here with the d electrons or with the transition elements, why electrons went into what we thought was still the third shell. So what we see now is that these shells are actually broken up into subshells. 1s, the first shell, only has one. The second shell has two subshells, and they are called 2s and 2p, and 2s takes in 2 electrons, and 2p takes in 6 electrons. And then we have 3s and 3p and 3d. So the n equals 3 shell has 1, 2, 3 subshells. And likewise, n equals 4 has 1, 2, 3, and then a fourth one down here below. And notice the order of filling gets a little complicated because the energy levels are all pretty close together as you add lots of electrons. So it doesn't follow 3s, 3p, 3d. It goes 3s, 3p, 4s, 3d. It's just the way it is, and we know that's the way it is because we can tell where the electrons are coming from. And we'll talk a little bit more about that. All right? We write electron configurations. You can read these off of the periodic table, all right? This is just a way of keeping track of where all the electrons are on the atom. So, for example, iron has an atomic number of 26 and has 26 electrons. So it's right over here in the periodic table. It's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 in from the beginning of the transition series. So if you just go back and look, you could write an electron configuration because you could just count off. You would have 1s2, 2s2, 2p6, 3s2, 3p6, 4s2, and then 3d6. All right? And that's what's on the slide here. Notice I don't really care which direction you put these in. Normally, you write them in the order of increasing increasing shell number. So from 1 to 2 to 3 to 4. But keep in mind here that there's something strange going on where the d electrons fill before the s. And sometimes we use a shorthand notation because very often we don't care about all these inner electrons. If we only care about the valence electrons, the ones that are available for bonding, we summarize this by saying 1s2, 2s2, 2p6, 3s2, 3p6, all the way up to there, is just argon. So sometimes we use these noble gases in brackets to just summarize everything that came before them. And then notice argon's right here, and we're looking at what comes after the argon core is filled. Okay? If you have questions, don't hesitate to ask. I think many of you have seen this before, but if you haven't, just ask questions. Here, what do you notice when you go down? So what happens? What changes as you go down? If you're looking at this noble gas core electron configuration, so what's changing as you go down the alkaline earth? The noble gas core, right? Because each of these, beryllium comes after helium, magnesium comes after neon, calcium comes after argon. But what do you notice about the outer the valence electrons? There's always two in the S, and all that's changing is whether it's a 2S subshell, 3S, 4S, 5S. All right? And what's changing as you go across? So if you look across from sodium all the way across to argon, you have the neon core, but what changes? Just the filling of the valence subshells. All right, it goes from 3s1 to 3s2, and then we start to get 3p1, and what do you notice? How many electrons can go in the p orbitals? 6. And we're gonna talk a little bit more about why that is. But for now, that's where the electrons are. We can also draw energy level diagrams. And what we mean by that is that these different subshells have different energies associated with them. What does it mean that 1s is really down low in energy? It means it costs a lot of energy to take the electrons out of that energy level. And that's not so likely to happen, for mostly we deal with the outer electrons. Now, this notation here uses arrows up and down to count the electrons, and it uses little boxes because, as we're going to learn next time, we have different subshells. Each subshell can have that the S subshell can have 2 electrons in it, and the P subshell can have 6 in it. So that's all we're keeping track of here. So this is for potassium. Potassium has 19 electrons. So how many do you expect to get, count across here? You better count the right number, right? 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12, 14, 16, 18, 19. All right? And this is where it's a little unusual in terms of the ordering of the energies. All right, now I want to show you one more. I'm going to go from potassium to vanadium, which is a few more elements over. First of all, where do you expect all the energy levels to be if I'm moving over to vanadium? So what's the difference between potassium and vanadium in terms of the nuclear charge? Higher nuclear charge on vanadium, so what do you expect to happen to all of these energy levels? They're going to go down a bit because there's going to be a stronger attraction. So here's vanadium, and I've purposefully drawn it down lower because vanadium has a larger positive charge in the nucleus. And I've added the rest of the electrons onto the electron configuration. It goes 3p6, 3d3, and 4s2. So it has 4 more electrons than potassium. They have filled the 4s shell and begun to fill the 3d shell. We'll talk more about why we draw them this way, but they want to spread out, so they go into different boxes for now, which are actually different orbitals that we're going to talk about. So just bear in mind that while the 4s fills first and then the 3d. Okay, it's just the way those work. And this isn't. I don't know how helpful this is. This is just a big drawing that says, look, when you have the 1s subshell, as you increase the atomic number, what happens to the energy of the 1s subshell? Goes down because there's a larger nuclear charge. Here's 2s and 2p, same thing, they go down. Here's 3s and 3p, they also go down, but 3d has a slightly different behavior. So it's right in here, this red line is showing you that the way the d subshell changes with atomic number is a little different than s and p. And in fact, what happens if you look at a close-up here, the 3d is kind of flat and then really falls off in energy, whereas the 4s is just coming down smoothly. And the net effect is that the 3D is higher in energy for potassium, but lower in energy for vanadium. Okay, it's just all it's saying is this is really complicated, and you can't really go in and know ahead of time. We measured, okay? We know where these orbitals are by measurement, okay? All right, so now what we're going to do today is we're going to examine the periodic trends. In particular, we're going to look at ionization energy, meaning how much energy is required to remove one electron. We've kind of already looked at that, and you're going to be looking at it in discussion. Electron attachment, how much energy is exchanged, released, as we'll see, when you attach an electron. And then what about the size? And the concepts that we're going to use, we're going to go back to concepts that we've heard before. We're going to use the electron configurations and the subshell model. We're going to look at the nuclear charge, an effective nuclear charge, and we're going to look at Coulomb's law. So the effective nuclear charge is just that the full nuclear charge is not experienced by every electron because other electrons get in the way and they reduce that charge. And so Coulomb's law just says that what we're ultimately going to be looking at is what's the effective nuclear charge on a given electron and how far are they apart. And those three concepts, the effective nuclear charge, the electron we're looking at, and how far apart they are, will help us understand all of these trends. Okay? All right, so now we're going to get down to, with that introduction, to business. All right. So here's the effective nuclear charge. If you were looking at lithium, lithium has three electrons. Here they are. This is in the 1s, and this is in the 2s. If you're looking at this 1s electron, why does it experience a greater attraction compared with the 2s electron? So give me a couple of reasons. Why does it experience a greater attraction? It's closer to the nucleus, all right? And what else? There's no shielding, meaning what? So there's no other negative charge that's getting in the way, okay? So these are going to feel probably pretty close to the full plus 3 charge, although they're going to repel each other a little bit, okay? So this will feel the full plus 3 charge, but what about this one? If we assume that these two can screen it or shield it perfectly, well, then this one, not only is it further apart, but what else? The charge is going to be much reduced. So two things are going on for this electron. It's further out, and the nuclear charge is going to be reduced by these other electrons that are getting in the way. And if we had perfect shielding, we would expect that this electron would only experience a plus 1 charge. So in other words, it goes out here, and it only feels plus 1 because these two are completely canceling two of those positive charges. Now, in fact, a better estimate, if you want to do better estimates, these don't do perfect shielding. There are ad hoc ways of counting for inner electrons and electrons in the same shell. Notice here, instead of taking off a full 2, you take off 2 times 0.85. The effective charge is closer to plus 1.3. So the point is you can calculate a Z effective with perfect shielding, but you can also calculate a Z effective with not such great shielding and get a better estimate. All right, but the point is that this outer electron that I'm looking at has a reduced effective nuclear charge compared with the real charge because of all the other electrons in between. All right, so now here's the graph, and I want you to take a moment and discuss with the people around you, why does the effective nuclear charge increase across, all right, as you go across a row, and then why does it increase when you go down from neon to argon, from fluorine to chlorine? So think about those two questions. How can you rationalize these trends based on what we just discussed? Okay, so take a moment to do that.
Thank you.
Okay. All right. So what do you think? Why does the effective increase across? That's pretty straightforward. Why does it increase across? What's happening as you go across? Okay, it's more protons, but where are the electrons? They're in the same shell, so what are they experiencing as you go across? Larger nuclear charge. All right, what's happening as you go down, though? Why it does argon, the outer electrons in argon, have a larger nuclear charge than neon? Why would that be? Well, it's got more protons, but you're adding a shell. But how do you think about that? I mean, why? What arguments are we making here about the outer electrons? What are the inner electrons doing? They're shielding. They're reducing that positive charge that the outer electrons are feeling. What's going to happen? Reason it out. As the atom gets bigger, less shielding. Why? Because it's a much bigger volume that it kind of has to shield. All right? So bear in mind that the effective nuclear charge does get larger as you go down because the shielding just gets worse. It's just a bigger space. Even though there's the same number of electrons in between the outer electrons and the inner electrons that could be canceling the charge, it's a much bigger volume. All right, now try this chem participation. You can talk to the other people around you. See if you can get the order of effective nuclear charge on these. Okay, five more seconds. Okay, so split between the first two. Now, why would krypton, which is at the end of the row, have the largest effective nuclear charge? Certainly, if we compare krypton, what you're thinking here? If you compare, we've got krypton here, down here, and then we have sulfur and then potassium, which is all the way at the beginning of the row with krypton. So if you were just comparing potassium and krypton, which one would win? Krypton, because it's at the end of a row, correct? All right, so we've got potassium and krypton in the right order. Question is, where are we going to put sulfur, right? And so if you look back at the chart, what do you notice about the how steep this trend is? So I've got, look at where lithium is, look at where sodium is. Where do you think, if you extrapolate out, where potassium might be? Okay, so my point is that 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 in this case, sulfur is probably likely to win out. So just take a look at those trends. All of you got the potassium krypton right, but I would have guessed from the steepness of this and how low down the alkali metal is that actually the sulfur would be have a higher effective nuclear charge than the potassium. Okay? All right. So it would be B. All right, now what about the ionization energy trends? Spend a moment to talk to one another about, well, they're up there, okay. They weren't supposed to be up here, this part. That was supposed to build in. All right, the point is what happens as you go down? What's happening to the ionization energy as you go down? This is the energy required to remove the outermost electron. What's happening? Goes down. How can it go down? The effective nuclear charge goes up. So why is it going down? Coulomb's law, what's the other part that's important? Radius. So in this case, there's actually a competition between an increase in effective nuclear charge, but an increase in radius. And so the energy, as it turns out, decreases as you go down. It's easier to remove electrons from the larger atoms. Because of the radius. And what happens as you go across? These are some complicated trends that you're going to look at in your discussion. In general, what do they do as you go up, as you go across? What happens to the ionization energy? It increases because the radius is staying roughly the same, and what's happening to the Z effective? It's getting bigger. All right. Now, notice there's some interesting substructure here that you will talk about in the discussions. What happens as you go from S to P? So on here, the blue are filling the S subshells, and then the yellow is showing what happens to the P subshells. What do you notice happens just as you go? You go from 1S to 2S, it goes up. Then what happens as you go to the P? Goes slightly down. Why might it go slightly down? What does that tell you about where the electrons are in those p orbitals? They're out a little further, okay? Becomes a little easier. So there's a lot of complexity to these trends that you can actually understand as you think about electron configurations and where the filling is. So here, try this chem quiz now. And see, it's very related to what we just did. It's asking if you take an electron out of the outermost shell for beryllium, costs 900 kilojoules per mole, what if you were going to take a second electron out? Would it require the same amount, more or less? See if you can reason that one out from your understanding of the atom. Okay, 5 more seconds. Okay, so the majority of you think that it's going to take more energy. Very few of you think the same. Now, while we think those electrons are sitting in the same orbital in the neutral atom or at the same energy in the neutral atom, do you have the same situation once you've removed an electron? No, because you've changed the electron-electron repulsions. You've and So you've changed the situation. Now, tell me why you think it might take more energy for those of you, a lot of you voted for C. Why do you think it will take more energy? So one electron's off. I've got a positively charged ion. So what happens now to take that second electron off? More energy, but why? Yeah, so you've already got a positive charge. It's larger compared to the negative charge. So you've got to make it now two plus, right? So that's going to be even harder to take it off. And you could also reason that you've reduced the electron-electron repulsions, meaning that that electron that you're trying to take away is attracted more strongly. Okay? All right, so C is the correct response here. Okay, so now... Now let's take a look at the radii. I want to go a little bit faster over these because I want to spend a little more time on the electron attachment. I think the radii are fairly obvious. Why are they getting bigger as you go down? Because, see, we're using the same arguments, because the radius is getting bigger. Why are they getting smaller as you go across? Effective nuclear charge is increasing. So this is sometimes a little confusing. Look at these size changes. If you look at atoms that are over on this side of the periodic table, they're quite small compared with atoms that are over here. And that's because they don't have a very high charge for those electrons that are being added in the outermost shell. The other thing I might point out is, why is there such a big change here from calcium to gallium? What comes in between? The whole transition metals. And what's happening all the way across the transition metals? Smaller, 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 smaller. Okay? So there's quite a contraction as you go across. And by the time you get to gallium, it's a really tiny atom compared with calcium. All right, so now here's a... quick participation quiz. Which ion has the largest radius? You're welcome to talk to one another about this. Which one do you think is the biggest? We just talked about the atoms. Now, what about the ions? Okay, 5 more seconds. Okay. Oh, so reasoning is all over the place, huh? All right, so why... what happens to electron repulsions when you remove electrons? Increase or decrease? Decreases. What happens to electron repulsions when you add electrons? Increase. If you have fewer electrons, what's going to happen to the attractions if you have fewer electrons to shield as you remove them to make a cation? More attractions, right? What's going to happen if you've added an electron and you don't even have the nuclear charge to compensate for it? It's going to be, it's not going to be very attracted to one another. So the correct answer here is chlorine. And if you look at them, look at these ion sizes. And I will post these because I know they're not on your sheet or you can find them on the web. But look at how tiny these cations are. And notice they even get tinier going from sodium plus to magnesium, 2 plus to aluminum. And look at these anions. They're enormous. Okay? And that's because of the electron repulsions and the lack of attraction. So one thing to keep in mind is you've got the radii trends, and you can study these to see if you can understand kind of the trends that you're seeing. But in general, the cations are just really small, and the anions are just really large. Okay, so now the last thing that I want to get to is electron attachment energies. Now, be careful. Lots of tables talk about electron affinities. We are actually going to talk about electron attachment because we want to know whether an electron is going to be attracted to make this anion. And so here are the values for this reaction for all of these elements. And so I want you to take a moment to discuss with one another whether you could understand what's happening as you go down and what's happening as you go across. You should be able to understand all of the details. So look, just for now, just look down this first column and see if you understand it. And then look across period two and see if you understand the signs and the magnitudes of the electron attachment energies. Okay? Okay, so what do you think? What's happening going down? Why does it become less favorable to attach an electron going down? Because they're larger atoms, right? Effective nuclear charge has gone up a little bit, but the atom's so large that the energy ends up going down. So less energy is released when you put an electron on rubidium compared to hydrogen. Tell me what's happening going across here. Why does beryllium have not even want to attach an electron? What's happened? The subshell has filled, right? So it's got, where does that electron have to go if you add one more electron onto beryllium? It has to go into the p orbital. And that actually costs energy rather than energy being released. Why doesn't neon attach any electrons? Where does the electron got to go? It has to go to the whole next shell, okay? And then one other one that's strange, what do you think might be going on at nitrogen for it to be positive rather than a negative number? So boron has how many electrons in the P? One. Carbon has two. Nitrogen has three. And then what happens when you try to attach another electron? Why might it be bad to put a fourth one in there? Because you have to pair them. There's three that are unpaired, and you have to bring another one in. All right, so for now, I'm going to end there because we have some business that we need to take care of. It turns out that there is a big game this weekend. And against some school, you know, it's down there over on the other side of the bay. We won't mention its name. And in the past, what we found, there's been a real history here. So you didn't know that you came into a chemistry department that has a long-standing tradition in making sure that we win the big game. Okay? So now, in order to win the big game, we have to do some magic here. Okay? So settle down, because we don't want to lose this game. And Professor Maida is coming to help me. Hurry up. He's agreed. He's agreed to help me. All right. So, it's been a big tradition that the chemists, in case you didn't know, are the ones that help Cal win the game. Oh, you need the microphone. Oh, here, he's going to have the microphone. All right. There's a few incantations that have to come.
Two impossible things have to happen. This red obviously has to go. But as you probably know, we are chemists, so maybe we can handle this. The other impossible thing has to happen is I have to sing this stuff, so that's very dicey. I embarrassed myself once already trying to sing, so why not the second time? So when I sing, you know, this after the first part, this thing, so this is your part with Professor Stacy, okay? the growling of the bear. So if I can sing, the Cal team definitely can win. All right, God, let me screw up. On our rugged eastern foothills, stand our symbol clear and bold. Big C means to fight and strive and win for big and gold. Gold Bay, every day watching, day by day he prowls. And when he hears a threat, the only sound for red, from his lap face he growls. We are the sons of California, fighting for the golden blue. Songs and stories and titrations soon will all be through. Stanford's men will soon be routed by laboratory. And when we stir this goo, the red will turn to blue.
More.
In this hour of chemistry, so as you know, the big game happened. Tomorrow is the anniversary in 1982, and it was a memorable year for both Professor Stacy and for me. For me, it was the first year on campus. I was new assistant professor then. And for Professor Stacy, it was the weekend that she interviewed for a job. And I voted for her to be hired. And you see what a good decision that was.
Okay, that was wonderful. And he's lucky he's alive, because he was walking across campus when the fans were pouring out of the stadium. And he said, "What's going on?" They said, "We won the big game." He goes, "What's that?" And there was toilet paper all over the place. It was incredible. So now I've got to get the, we have to watch it. If you haven't seen it, it is the most amazing. All right, so you want to put this, and we need the sound. Oh, I got to do my thing. This one? Which one? And what about the sound?
Can the booth get the sound up? Pause it.
Do we have the sound? Oh, we need the sound. The sound is the best part. It's not the same without the sound. The two Calvans have it memorized. So the score was 19 to 20 at the end of the game for those of you who don't follow football. All right? And this is the end of the game. How do you do full screen?
Is this on? What happened?
Oh well, so much for full screen.
Do they still have a video?
I don't know, do they? Oh.
So what happened?
I don't know. Can you go back?
Well, you need to be online.
Oh. All right, just play it from there. Okay. Hopefully we'll win. And thanks again to Professor Maida.